This is Deanna Spingola. It is Monday. It is June 18th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Frank L. DeSilva. Frank, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Deanna, and I want to say at the outset that you have done a great service to your people, and we all appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Now, you belong to something called the Order.
Yes.
Could you tell us just a little bit about the Order, what led to the formation of the Order, and what it was?
Yes, ma'am. Specifically, the name of this organization was the Silent Brotherhood. The media, in the due course of our trial in 1985, tended to stick us with the name Order, but that's the most publicly known name, so we can run with that. I guess to start off briefly, in the beginning, the early 80s, late 70s was quite a time of change, and traditional values were they were disappearing, let's say. And after a while, listening to some of the older speakers, ranging from Richard Butler, Robert Miles, Thomas Robb, Willis Carto, a lot of individuals that were public figures at the time, we just didn't seem to be getting anywhere. So, as youth is, we just decided that talk was enough, and we did what we felt we had to do.
And what was that?
What we were alleged to have done was to rob several armored cars. Just generally, we became a direct action type of group that we're trying to facilitate, in one end, a territorial imperative, or what we now call the Homeland Initiative. Specifically, that means that we were trying to engage in a movement that would guarantee that we could secure a place for our people and a future for white children.
Okay. So was this in response to any particular movement that was going on that was disturbing to you?
Well, that's a big question, but let me see if I can answer that. We had tremendous communist influence in the late 40s, early 50s. We had responses like the Minutemen of Robert Depew. We had various Klan factions around the country, John Birch Society. Traditional values were under attack, just like they are now. And from institutional standpoints, each and every conservative group had their answer, or at least they had their attempt. It might have been through a church, might have been through a political organization, might have been, you know, just on a personal level. But this was the first time in an organized fashion that an attempt was made to derail or, in fact, eliminate what a lot of people call the progressive liberal agenda.
Okay. And this was, now you mentioned the John Birch Society.
Yes, ma'am.
And I can't remember when that started. Was that in the 70s or the 60s?
I believe it was in the late 50s, early 60s.
Okay. Was there any group that seemed to accommodate the needs of you and your associates?
At the time or in
yes,
prior history?
Yes, at the time.
Not really. I will harp on this continuously, not on this interview, but just generally speaking, not the conservative element vis-a-vis either religious organizations or political manifestations, by definition, encourage a conservation of, you know, whatever eschatology they are performing or they put out to the public. It could be a fundamentalist Christian attitude. It could be a quote-unquote economic or fiscal conservatism. But generally speaking, conservatives have not changed or saved anything. That would include in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So when the 80s rolled around, I guess my generation just finally had enough, and everybody else was just simply talking, and we needed to actually do something.
Right. And I personally believe that a lot of those groups were infiltrated immediately, or they were set up by the very opposition that you and your associates were trying to oppose.
Yes, ma'am. And I would go as far as to point out Operation COINTELPRO, which is an old 50s and 60s FBI plan to eliminate leadership and fundamentally disrupt any and all organizations. You also had Operation Garden Plot, which was designed specifically to disrupt the American Indian movement and some African American groups.
Well, that's interesting. The American Indian Movement, AIM, had a very, very bad reputation, and of course, the media just, raked them over the coals and said all kinds of terrible things about them.
Yes, ma'am.
And yet, these people were actually could tell what was going on and were responding to it, I think, probably pretty appropriately.
In the same fashion as all tribal mechanisms respond to an outside threat, they were doing no different than us or some of the earlier agitators, like the SDS, Weather Underground. That's not specifically a tribal mechanism, but they were speaking for the majority point of view of the African American community.
Okay. Now you mentioned the Weather Underground. That has also gotten a bad rap, of course, in the media. Any kind of a group that opposes the status quo or what is going on is certainly going to be vilified in the media because the media is corporate owned, and it is owned by the very people that these groups would be opposing. And so, of course, they're going to get vilified.
Yes, ma'am. Now, in terms of the 60s revolutionary movement, it's kind of interesting because I don't claim to be a part of the legacy of that. Just by definition, it is what it is. But all groups who become extreme, by definition, cannot speak within their communities, their political structures, whatever. So therefore, they will do something on their own. In that respect, all groups that commit to direct action of some type will have that similarity, but that's pretty much where it ends for us.
Okay, in the Wikipedia that I read, which talks about the order, it claims that your group participated in some bank robberies or, well, it says that you robbed a sex shop. So tell us about that.
Okay.
And
Well,
also some bank robberies.
yes, ma'am. If I right off the top of my head, because I don't have notes usually when I talk to people, but I think the way it ran down sequentially, this would be allegations necessarily, would have been the porno store. Everything was designed to raise funds for what later became the white nationalist movement. You could have called it the right wing, the patriotic movement, Christian identity, that kind of thing back in the 70s and 80s. But even as now, there was just no funds. People didn't have a place to send money, or they were afraid that monies were going to be intercepted, so on and so forth. So you had to have a source of income. And every revolution, every action-oriented political outlook needs to be funded, and consequently, porno shop allegedly was hit. Then, no one bank robbery, I guess, by Robert J. Matthews. They alleged that, but no one was ever charged with that. Then after that, there were two. I don't know if they were Wells Fargo armored cars, but they were hit in Seattle, and the largest one was hit in Ukiah, California.
Now, were those the actions of your group?
I will say that they were definitely charges that were levied against us in trial in Seattle in 1985. Yes.
But did your group actually commit these? crimes.
Well, no one was found guilty of them, but bottom line is, even if the group did participate and were responsible for these events, it was done specifically to garner funds.
Okay. So there were people who were tried for it, Robert Matthews specifically?
He was deceased at the time. He was murdered by approximately 150 to 175 agents on Whidbey Island, Washington, where they assaulted the house, exchanged gunfire for approximately 36 hours, and then engaged an aerial assault by which they fired at least a minimum of two M79 grenades, which imploded the roof, and he consequently was burnt to death.
Oh my gosh, and it took all of that just for one man, or were there other people in the house at the time?
There was no other individuals in the home at the time, but prior to that, there were several families on this particular island. This story is quite lengthy, but in a nutshell, there were different cells that were engaged at the moment and were staying on the island. So they had to take each particular cell one by one, and there were two, with the third being Robert J. And at that time, the assault started on December 8th, it ended on December 8th with his death.
December 8th of 83?
Of 84.
84.
Yes, ma'am. As a side note, Deanna, we know this from talking to many government officials, but there were two individuals there that were wearing blue berets with tiger stripe uniforms. And from what I was told personally by a government official, was that they were two Israeli colonels. And at some level, we're not quite sure exactly, they were in charge of at least a part or the entire group of Delta Force members that had been designated to sections of the Northwest. And that is quite an interesting development.
Now, would you call this a Waco-style event?
It was a precursor to Waco. Historically, if you care to really search this out, the Branch Davidians knew of the Randy Weaver incident and also knew of the Robert J. Matthews incident, but you don't see much about Robert in the media. You will see a little bit about Randy Weaver and a lot about the Waco, but these are all sequential events, and your radio show in this interview is kind of a, you know, it's a special interview. Nobody else has really heard this put together, that there is a sequential series of events that were started specifically by the creation of the Brüderswagen, the death of Robert J. Matthews, and the rest all followed in conjunction with that.
Wow.
And if I may say too, Deanna, that Gordon Cole, does that name ring a bell?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. In fact, I attempted to contact Gordon Cole's wife, and but she, Joan, is it Joan Cole?
Yes, ma'am.
It's been probably a year ago, and she did not want to be on the radio. I think she just... Maybe she's just given up.
She's tired. She's real tired.
And their son is also in prison, correct?
Yes, Yuri was, I believe, 17 when he was placed in Lewisburg Penitentiary in Pennsylvania, which he was the youngest ever of all the young men that have ever been placed in a place like that. I think he was 17 or 17 and a half, and when I met him, in 92 or 93, he had been down, I think, 12 or 15 years, maybe a little bit longer. And that whole duration, his mother has supported him every step of the way. Gentlemen like Jack McLam, who you might be familiar with.
Yes.
Has tried for years through letter writing campaigns, talking to senators, congressmen, to try to get Yuri out. He did nothing, Deanna, but just be there.
He was in the car.
Yes, ma'am.
And this was in the 1980s too. So what year was that?
This would have been in 1982.
Oh my goodness, and he's still there?
Yes, ma'am.
That's incredible.
Yes, it is, ma'am. It's definitely incredible.
I mean, we're talking 50 years here.
Well,
no,
been,
40.
You
know, 40.
Yeah, probably, let's see, 82.
30?
Yeah, it's going on 30 years.
Yeah, 30 years, okay. For just being in a car.
Well, he was not in the car. He was outside standing. His father, there was a roadblock, and his father stood up and said, "What's going on?" Joan was in the car. The mother was in the car. And upon being fired upon by the, I believe it was the state police, I'm not entirely sure, but Gordon responded in kind, and there were at least a singular fatality. But Yori received a stray bullet, hit his 45 over his heart, and the splinters went, almost penetrated his heart. He almost died, and they were not trying to give him medical attention. Gordon got Yori to the hospital and basically told the doctors to let him die, but the doctors refused to do that, and Yori lived.
And their crime, really, the supposed crime was that they were opposing income tax, or
yes,
they were just opposing general tyrannical government tactics. Isn't that correct?
Well, we could start out with the beginning, and that was definitely, Gordon was against taxation without representation, and the rest of it, as you probably well know, would be the tyrannical part of a government that does not speak for us.
And they certainly haven't for a very long time. Maybe they never did.
Maybe.
Wow. Okay. So he opposed income taxes and basically tyranny. And so they gunned him down.
Well, remember, he was a World War II veteran. He was decorated. This is Gordon Cullen we're speaking about. He was a patriotic Christian, and he was a free man. He looked at himself as the head of his house, like all individual family members have head of household, and he didn't believe that the system was protecting his children, his wife, himself, and he had a right to stand up and say something about it. And when he did, he was shot down. He was put in prison. I can't remember how long Gordon was in. I think 4 years, 4 or 5 years for tax evasion. And when he came out, I don't think he was a very happy man, but he moderated his behavior, was a good husband, good father, and then circumstances just propelled him, you know, into an international incident, because it was international.
Oh my, okay. And so, so the order, or the Silent Brotherhood.
Yes, ma'am.
It was started just about at this time.
Yeah, approximately a year later. The reason why I brought him up was that Gordon was a hero to Bob, and to most of the men in the white nationalist movement at that time. He was a folk hero to the Midwest, but more so he was a revolutionary kind of a character to, you know, a lot of the younger guys, because he was a man of action, and the younger men were willing to follow men of action.
Wow. So who basically, was it Matthews that founded the order, and when, September 1983?
I don't know if it was September, but let's use that for the time being. Robert J. Matthews was, in fact, the founder of the Silent Brotherhood. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, and he lived in Washington, and it was founded on a farm where he lived?
He had a ranch where he raised Galloway cattle, and he worked in the local mine there.
Okay, and he was a member of the Mormon Church?
At one time, yes.
Okay. And some of the people who joined this movement were also Mormon survivalists?
I'd say that there was a small contingent of men and women who at one time had been involved with the Mormon Church or fundamentalist Christian types, including Christian identity. And if you remember back in the 70s and 80s, there was a disproportionate amount of survivalism, you know, kind of an Armageddon type of scenario. Ronald Reagan had just been elected president. Jimmy Carter was going out. The nation was in flux once again. Religious and personal morals were changing at such a rapid pace that institutions just could not keep up with it. And I once again will reiterate that the conservatives of that time were totally cowardly. They would not stand for anything. So.
Exactly. And that was, of course, 10 years after the Supreme Court okayed abortion.
Yes, ma'am.
So there were a lot of things going on at the time that that would have affected Christian people, and so I can see where a group might be a good thing to a group such as yours would have been very alarmed by what was going on in the country.
Sure. I mean, you could take 1% from any church, any Boy Scout group, any conservative, you know, political organization, you're going to find those people that just were ready to stand up and say no. And if the leaders of these particular groups, especially religious groups, I know I'm a little bit, I'm probably a little bit rough around the edges when it comes to that, but the church, by definition, leads the congregation, leads the people. And from the pulpit, if you remember back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, for the most part, they just totally caved in. And there was no folk leadership. And a term that we use, Deanna, is the folk community. There were no leaders of the folk community, per se, except for these groups like Richard Butler's Aryan Nations, or some Klan groups, or some Minutemen groups. These were the quote, direct action-oriented type of people. And it was the only place that people could really go to.
Well, the churches actually signed up with the government in 1965 when they opted to take a tax-exempt status.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much.
So basically they were silenced, willingly they were silenced, because the money seemed to be probably what more important than standing up for morality?
I would agree with that 100%, yes.
And so how did the Mormon Church respond or react to their members being involved with this group?
You know, I can't make a comment that's sweeping in scope, because, you know, there was no direct Mormon involvement. So let's keep Mitt Romney and the crew up out of this. The church as an institution didn't have a clue what was going on, I'm sure. But there is a fundamentalist aspect of all religious factions, and, you know, specifically the people that were associated either directly or indirectly with a lot of the gentlemen that I was acquainted with were very devout Mormons, very devout Christians in general. There were Catholics, there were Protestants, there were what we now call pre-Christian believers, like believers in Astru. That's the old pre-Christian religion of Europe.
Right.
You know, so there was a very diverse, this was not a singular effort. You got to remember, when you speak with me or people who think like me as white nationalists, we are unifiers. I'm not looking to garner support from one institution or another. We're all the same people. We all have the same basic traditional values. We all consider ourselves members of the Republic, sons and daughters of the Republic, if you will. And that means Western civilization. And that's what we're trying to defend.
Right. Now, the FBI considered this group and other groups like it as white supremacist. But that is not what it is all about. It's really about nationalism, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Give me your definition of nationalism.
Well, nationalism, by definition, includes a people, which is a race, which is defined by particular geographical boundaries. That is the traditional definition of nation. And being a nationalist, I am for my people, which is my nation.
Okay, and why is that? Why is white nationalism important for us today? I mean, it seems with all the multiculturalism and all of the other groups that have been allowed to invade our country and have actually been invited into our country, it just seems that that we have such a diversion, so many other groups. Why is white nationalism important?
Well, I would say specifically that white nationalism looks out first and foremost for the future extension of one people, and that's the Western white European peoples. We are a tribe, just like all the other race cultures of the world are, and we are a defined and definitive group of people with traditions, with moral values that have been projected on us over thousands of generations. So white nationalism can be summed up with the 14 words, and I'll say this again and again. We must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And that pretty much puts it in a nutshell.
All righty. And do you feel that this is still a valid objective?
Yes, I do.
And in what way are you promoting it? In what way are you trying to educate others about this?
On an individual level, I do my writing, which can be viewed on Amazon.com. Just, you can either put my name in or Rise of the West, which is my first book. And after that, any kind of political manifestations that I can, you know, become acquainted with, like the American Third Position Party, you know, within reason, the Populist Party, but that's been confused and rearranged as well. Too. It's not really nationalistic in nature. It's just, it's basically a neoliberal kind of a party. Not that I disagree fundamentally with it, but it doesn't really focus on the needs of our people. Crime, economics, land ownership, that kind of thing. Only white nationalists focus on these issues.
Okay, and so you have books and people can find them?
Yes, ma'am.
On Amazon. And do they sell well? Do people contact you and talk to you about what you've written?
Not so much contact, they sell. But it's not brisk sales, no, unfortunately. So let's drum up some business for me.
All righty. And you write under the name Frank L. De Silva.
Yes, ma'am.
Have you been on, let's see, you just had one come out, Poems for the Folk?
That was one of the first ones. Sequentially, it's Rise of the West, Song of Albion, then Remember Tomorrow, then Poems for the Folk, and then the last one, which I would encourage everybody to get their hands on, is Foundations of the 21st Century, The Philosophy of White Nationalism, which is the latest work.
Okay, Foundations for the 20... Repeat that.
Foundations of the 21st Century.
Okay. Do you see much hope in this country for a return of white nationalism?
White nationalism's never left, but I definitely see a resurgence and a positive step forward. Yes, I do.
Now, you belong to a group... And and there was a trial in 1985 in Seattle. Why did they go again? Why did the government decide to take this group to trial?
Okay, well, first off, Deanna, let me say that this group no longer exists, so I am not a member of any active group. That's number one.
Okay.
Number two, to answer your question, the government as an institution was not really aware of any, quote, group. Indeed, I don't think that they're seriously aware of how you or I or individuals like us really do feel on a human level. So when the causal actions occurred, i.e. The armored cars or things of that nature, when they got operational, they really didn't know where to start, and they were looking from the East Coast to the West Coast, the Midwest to Minutemen to Klansmen. They didn't know. They actually, you know, it had been 50 years of talk. So this was the first, and they really didn't know what was going on for at least 18 months.
Interesting. Now, okay, are you there?
Yep. Yes, ma'am.
All righty. How do you feel about Dr. David Duke's work? Do you embrace his work, or?
I would say that Dr. Duke is doing a fine job in the purview that he rests comfortably in, and each one of us do what we can.
All righty. I'm looking for the book. I'm looking for Foundations for, let's see, the 21st Century.
Okay, go to Amazon.com.
Okay.
Put in Rise of the West.
All righty.
When it comes up, you'll see the author's name on that page.
Oh, okay. A History of Human Community.
Yes, ma'am. No, the one right below
that. Right below it. Okay, got it.
Okay.
Okay.
Hit the name, hit the author's name, and that'll bring you up to the page that has a selection of the works, and you can choose which one you want to see.
Okay. All righty. And this book just came out February 1st of 2012, Foundations of the 21st Century, The Philosophy of White Nationalism.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And and you say that it is selling well, or?
Well, it hasn't really had a long time out in the public eye yet, so we've sold a few copies, but it could be a lot better.
Okay. Have to look and see. Did you self-publish?
Yes, ma'am. That's a whole other issue, because the conservative elements will publish Pat Buchanan, and while erudite as he's not really offering anything new. He doesn't give answers to anything or secular positions that would garner a political response. He knows what he's talking about, men like Pat Buchanan. But in Foundations, it lays out what we had already formulated in the early 80s, what type of government we want, our positions on labor, our positions on land ownership, taxation, you know, everything that was a cumulative mind trust in the late 70s, early 80s is brought to the fore in that work.
All right. One of the links off of this Wikipedia page talks about the Zionist government, the Zionist occupation government.
Yes.
Is that something that you talk about or address?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's an acronym. It was developed by a man by the name of David Eden Lane, who coined the 14 words and also developed what we now know as the 88 precepts, which is a very, you should read them yourself and make up your own mind what kind of a presentation it really is. But the Zionist Occupational Government was one of those acronyms that pretty much spelled out what everybody felt in the 70s and 80s, that the government had been hijacked, and for all intent and purposes, either, however you look at it, a religious or racial group of people did in fact have the majority impetus in our government and had sequestered and taken over, you know, constitutional issues, rights, moral attitudes, and hence you had, you know, elements that created that acronym.
Okay. And you talk about the 88 precepts.
Yes, ma'am.
And where might those be found on the web?
To my knowledge, you can find them. Sorry about the background noise.
Yikes. They're coming after you.
Yeah, yeah. You can find them on pyramidprophecy.com, or it's DavidLane1488.com, one of those two.
Okay.
And once you pull that up, you'll look for the 88 precepts.
All righty. What are some of the most important?
I'm sorry you asked me that question because I don't have it memorized by rote.
Oh, okay. But okay, now you already mentioned that you have a problem with some background noise. I don't know whether you can mute your mic or not. But you're in a public place and you're doing this program because it's important that this information gets out. And I'm glad that you agreed to do this because I think this is very important. And I think that that if I were if I were asked what I am, I would have to say that I am a nationalist, certainly, because I care about my country. I care about nationalism as opposed to internationalism, which is what the Zionists have certainly imposed upon us through their takeover of our government, our media, our schools, just about everything that that ha has a has the ability to provide perceptions for the population of the United States. I mean,
I would agree with that. Can I add a little something to that,
please,
though?
please.
I've said often, and I will continue to say it more. Remember, simply because we have opposing elements within the political body of our country, they're not the problem. We are the problem. We have allowed this. It's our responsibility, both men and women, if there is a wrong done, to stand up and say, "No, you cannot and will not do it again." We know that these things existed. We knew that they existed in the 20s and 30s. We knew when the Federal Reserve was created that it was wrong. Men like Augustus Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, Father Coughlin, Gerald K. Smith, I mean, some tremendous Americans have stood up and said, "This is un-American, it's wrong." And we failed. You and I, our ancestors, failed to address these issues. Just because these people are successful is not because they're smarter, but they do work harder than us. I'll give them that. So through white nationalism or your feelings of nationalism, religion, whatever, in a cumulative fashion, we can stop them at any time. At any time.
Really,
Yes, really.
I think that people feel like it's a hopeless situation, because they have the control of the media, they have control of credit, they have control of so many aspects of our lives, that I think most people feel hopeless about changing the tide.
Yes, ma'am, but I got news for you and everybody else out there. The whole concept and construct of white nationalism is that we want our own nation. Look at Ukraine, look at Azerbaijan, look at Georgia, look at the various national states that have been created in the last 25 to 30 years. It is not impossible, neither is it beyond the pale. If our forefathers had said they were just going to work within the system of the crown, we would not exist as a corporate state, as a republic. And if that is a given, then if people like yourself, myself, and millions of us who want to just actually create or maintain what we believe in, which is right and righteous, we can demand and, in fact, start a cumulative effort to secure our own sovereign nation somewhere. This is not pie in the sky. This is fundamental political structure here. And I hope people think about that.
Now, you compared your book to some of the books that Buchanan has written, and he doesn't give any solution. He just talks about the problem. In your book, Foundations of the 21st Century, do you provide a way of getting out of the system and doing what you just recommended?
What I've offered is very strict procedural aspects. Like I mentioned earlier, we have positions on labor, we have positions on finance, we have positions on land ownership. In consequence to that, people then have to, one, start a political group or get behind a couple of the existing groups, take them over, and start really pushing these more, and I guess I can say they're extreme elements, but in 20 years they won't be. They'll be standard fare. So action is based on an idea. Once you have the idea in these foundations, then you can proceed accordingly. But certainly, Deanna, people will have to excuse themselves from the ranks of modern-day conservatism. It's just not going to help us.
Well, I think conservatism it's been taken over. I mean, whether you're talking about the left or the right, the Jews control both of those sides, the liberals and the conservatives. I mean, they're both controlled.
Well, Deanna, they may control by influence, but remember, the majority of the membership is our people. So therefore, once again, I lay this out for you and everybody to consider. It may be an overwhelming philosophical position that is held by Zionists and whatever element you want to think of, but it's our people that are going along with it. So you pull out of those groups and you start your own, or you join groups that are much more politically and socially aligned to you, and you promote those things. You give donations to those groups. You know, I mean, funding, all revolutions, all movements require funds, because those issues are very hungry. They need to be fed, and money is the food that makes all this move. When I was 19 or 20 years old, I was pushing what the older guys called a corporatism. For years, I said, how come we don't have our own buildings? How come the SPLC can have theirs, or the NAACP can have their buildings? Why can't we? And when I was young, I was told by the older people that it's impossible. And I says, well, maybe for you it was, but not for me. And I was working very diligently to facilitate that end, and then destiny, being the strange mistress that it is, just carried me off. But fundamentally, what was impossible 40 years ago is possible today.
Really?
Sure it is. Look at your radio station. Your radio station wasn't around 15 or 20 years ago. I remember hearing my first satellite transmission on a bootleg radio in prison in 1992.
Wow. Well, I do believe that the internet is a big boon to helping to educate the people, and certainly I'm very grateful for the internet and for my radio program, the biggest objective is to get more people to turn off their televisions and turn on to internet radio so they can really actually hear the truth. And, you know, although the elite, you know, built the internet for their own purposes, I believe it's kind of backfired on them to the extent that it does allow more people to do more research to figure out who's behind their problems.
Yes, it does, Deanna, but I would add a caveat to this as well. Being on a keyboard and doing this research tends to make us even more atomized, and I would strongly suggest yourself and your listeners, anybody that's going to hear this interview, to strongly remember what it was like to meet in a local park like I do, to bring 50 or 60 or 100 people to a barbecue, to a church picnic, to whatever, because socialization is the only way that we are really going to achieve any kind of dynamic here. It's okay to talk. It's okay for people to hear your words, but you need physical contact. You actually need socialization like that. And I would encourage everybody to not be afraid and go out and socialize with each other. Talk about these things. Put a placard up. We have the young people are doing this South Africa project. Have you heard about that?
No.
David Duke, I don't think he started it, but I think he supported that. Dr. McDonald gave a small speech in Los Angeles about 3 or 4 weeks ago. This was an activity that was in support of the Boers in South Africa, which is very close to my heart and a lot of people that I know. So when these kind of venues occasion themselves, then people need to get off of their asses and get out there and at least spend an hour or 2 hours participating.
Right. So what you're saying is, yes, the internet is great, but we shouldn't sit in front of our computers doing all of this research unless we're willing to go out and meet with other like-minded people to feel like we are not alone. Because quite frankly, when you're sitting in front of your computer, you are virtually alone. And I believe that that they would like us to feel very isolated.
Precisely.
Yes.
And remember that what the scriptures say, faith without works is dead.
Yes. How true. Well, this has been very interesting. Would you care to add some other admonitions?
No, just that I personally believe in my people and men like myself. We have dedicated our lives to this at one level or another. I mean, you know, I would like to be a part of a political movement, but on a personal note, remember, everybody out there who's listening, is that you have friends, you have compatriots, you have comrades, and don't fear the beast or whatever you want to call it. It was changed by individuals, and individuals can change it back.
Certainly, and I believe that there are people in the so-called truth movement who would like us to be so afraid, and that, you know, they talk about the FEMA camps, they talk about all of these things, and certainly the Waco event and other events, Gordon Call's situation, people are likely to think, wow, I don't want that to happen to me, I just better keep my mouth shut. But that's not what is going to move us forward, and that is not going to solve the problem. We need to get rid of our fear and join with the other people, like-minded people, correct?
Well, you're a good woman, because you took the words right out of my mouth, and that shows a lot of courage, Deanna. And the bottom line is, here's a word to these hucksters out there. The biggest enemy that our folk face are these fear mongers, these hucksters, these people that sell gold and silver and currency, and they make money off of our people every single day, and not one penny is put back into the folk. And I can tell you that from experience. And these kind of people, I want them to understand this. Their time is over with. If you are not folk-based, if you don't really believe in building a storefront somewhere, even providing soup kitchens for our homeless, because that's the only people I see that are homeless today on the street corners is our people. If they don't support a local church that is, I mean, really is a church for our people that has social programs, then these people are traitors. And I'll say it again, these people are traitors who do not support their people after their people have supported them.
Wow. I agree. I really do. Well, I really appreciate you talking with me this afternoon, and I hope that we can do this again.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you, Deanna. And like I said, you've done a great service to your people, and I for one, appreciate it. And carry on. You're a very courageous woman, and hope to speak to you again.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.